Open the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits for April 18th, 2017. We have four items on the agenda. I'm actually going to take the last item first, that way they can come and present, and we can get on to our more informational items. So if you'd please come forward from the Oregon Department of Transportation. This is their response to the Secretary of State's audit. And Ms. McHugh, did you want to do any preview on this?
Or? The only thing, Mr. Chair, that I will mention is that we did attach the audit. This is one that you heard from the Secretary of State previously, and according to kind of our methodology about how we're going to do some of this is we always want to give an opportunity for the agency to come and talk about the audit findings, their plans, as well as just about how the process worked. So that, with that, I will turn over to Mr. Mather.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Mather. I'm the Highway Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm going to go over with you our response to the audit that's from Secretary of State's office that Audit Manager Andrew Love went over with you roughly a month ago. So I'm not going to go through a lot of what he did. I'm going to try to cover our response, maybe cover a few examples to kind of illustrate some of the points that we make in our response, but spend most of the time just talking about the four recommendations that are in the audit. I guess I want to start with those four recommendations in that we support those four recommendations. We're in the process of implementing those, and I'll go into some detail, but I'm going to give you several kind of comments around some concerns in the audit about how it was kind of framed up, or some of the context set around those four audits that we had concern with that you'll see in our response. But know as I go through this, those four recommendations, and again, I'll come back to those in detail, but we support those recommendations and are currently moving forward and implementing those recommendations. So unbalanced bidding. So what is unbalanced bidding? It's when, through the low bid process, contractors submit abnormally low or high financial bids on a project. A little background on our projects, the way we put our low bid projects together. We put together estimated quantities on different bid items. As you heard in the previous testimony, we could have up to 1,000 bid items on a project. As we go through and put our contracts together, we put them together in a way that all bidders can bid on them in a fair level playing field. But obviously each contractor has their own competitive advantage that they have in the field, and they will bid accordingly and try to structure their bids in a way that minimize their risk, maximize their profits. And a lot of the ways they do that is with unbalanced bidding. The estimates that we have in our contract are estimated amounts. The amount we pay are on actual amounts. So we'll go through and make estimates, but when the contractor actually puts down so many tons of asphalt or moves so many yards of material, they get paid on actual amounts. So I think I'll illustrate maybe a couple of examples of when it kind of makes sense for contractors, or when they, maybe it makes sense, but when they use unbalanced bidding. A project that we recently committed or completed just north of here, the Woodburn Interchange. So we went through and put together the plan, specifications, and the approach to that project. Had many bid items, could have been as many as 1,000 bid items on that project. But we estimated that that project was going to take up to 3 years to complete. When you look at the work windows for traffic, weather, for paving, working around the outlet mall, holidays, so forth, and we put together our assumptions and how a contractor is going to approach that. The particular contractor looks at that approach and may say, in fact, I believe it's true of the contractor that actually won that contract, looked at it and said, you know, the approach I'm going to take as a contractor, I'm going to complete that project in less time. In fact, I'm going to try to complete that in 2 years. So we have an estimated amount of flagging, for example, in the project for maybe 1,000 or several thousand hours of flagging, assuming it's going to be a three-year project. Well, that contractor, assuming they're going to do it in less, will bid very low on that bid item to give them an advantage in the low bid process. To minimize their risk, they will then maybe bid higher in a bid item that they're going to receive payment for early on in the contract to minimize their risk if they do end up going to a three-year contract. So it's a way for them to shift risk and also to maximize their approach relative to their competitors in achieving that bid. Another example maybe in how we put together plans and specifications maybe for an approach that we assume a particular detour or frontage road or temporary connection needs to be built to build the project. As the contractor takes their approach, they may look and say, you know, I can approach that a different way with the equipment, means, and methods that I have to approach this project. And I'm not even going to build that temporary approach. And maybe it's zero or, again, a very low dollar amount on that, again, with the end motivation of winning the bid and minimizing the risk and maximizing the profits. So, you know, unbalanced bid is part of the nature of low bid contracts and the way we do things. In fact, my understanding, just some of the techniques I described here are taught in some of the schools, even at Oregon State, for those that go into contract management, some of the ways for contractors to minimize their risk and maximize their profits going forward. So unbalanced bidding in and of itself is not bad, is really the point I'm making. You know, it's also, as you read the audit, another point I would make to make sure or to highlight is project budgets versus the contract amount. So as you read the audit, I think a lot of leaders would be led to believe that the contract amount is the budget for the project. In many cases, or some cases that may be true, but many cases that's not true. The contract is only one piece of the project budget. The project budget entails our engineering costs, the right-of-way costs, in a lot of cases can make up several different contracts to complete the project. In many cases, or some cases anyway, we'll actually make a conscious decision to go over the contract amount to benefit the project and ultimately save taxpayers money or to actually benefit the overall project. I think an easy example of that is a paving project we were doing last summer. This is out on 395, out in Alkali Lake. If you're familiar with the middle of nowhere, that's where this project is, north of Lakeview, south of Burns. Paving contract for a significant stretch of 395, $30 million project. We went through and did the bids, let the contract for that, and received extremely favorable bids relative to the amount of money we had dedicated for the project. So we paid quite a bit of money to mobilize a contractor out there. It had more highway that needed to be repaved, so we negotiated a change order with the contractor to extend the limit, extend their bid prices, and get more paving done. If you look at just the contract amount, we went way, way over the contract amount, but if you look at the budget for that project, the amount of money we had dedicated, we were well under that. And I would argue we made a wise decision for the people of Oregon in maximizing the resources we had to get the roads paved. So I just highlight that to when you read the audit, to kind of keep that in your head. The project budget is not the contract amount. The contract amount is the amount for the contract. The budget is a separate one that we manage and make decisions on separately. Another area I'd like to highlight is just the our project accounting that we do on projects. If you read the audit, they make a statement that 96% of the projects exceeded their bid amounts. When they drew up and came to that number of 69% amount that achieved their bid amounts, what they did is they looked at the amount the contractor bidded at the time of bid opening, and then went to the end of the contract and looked at what we paid for those amounts. What they included in that, which from our point of view, they shouldn't have included, as many different accounting pieces in the project that aren't appropriate to make that comparison. For example, we pay bonuses for smoothness on pavements. Those bonuses get paid regardless of how we manage or not manage the contract. We obviously have change orders on contracts. We have escalation clauses in the contract. So if the price of oil goes up, price of steel goes up, those automatically kick in. So you've put in into the accounting of the project, you've included when the Secretary of State's audit made that office or made that comparison to come up with that 69% exceeded the number, they included many of those things that we believe they shouldn't. If you look at strictly the amount that was paid in the bid item, exclude all those things that I talked about, that number is not 69%. It's actually closer to about 29 or 30% of the projects. I think just the final point and just the overall context of the audit before I get to the recommendations, I think the most, I think, telling piece that they found in the audit is when you total up the total amount of dollars that in the contracts they looked at, over 400 contracts, the total authorization amount on all those contracts was about $1.9 billion. When you look at the amount we paid on those contracts, it was $1.8 billion. So if we really had, I think, a serious, serious issue here, I think you would see, you know, some different numbers there. Not to say we don't potentially have some projects nested in there that if we had this better data, had a better understanding of unbalanced bidding, there probably is some nuance in there. But if we really had, I think, an extremely serious problem here, you would see those numbers and those contract amounts look differently. So turning to...
Yes, we have a question.
Sure.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Coach, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the first page where you're just talking about 413 projects, $1.8 billion, but the total cost was below the total estimated cost of $1.9. 69% exceeded their bid. So you got to really look at... You're giving me a number of projects, but not the amount of each one of those. Right? Are we comparing? There's 413 projects, so 70% of those exceeded their bid amount.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woods, that's the conclusion that Secretary of State's audit office came to. When we ran the numbers, and I think what, in our estimation, the proper project accounting and took out those kind of automatic pay items into the contract and really looked at apples versus apples, that 69% number isn't correct. That number is 29%.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But again, just like your example you gave us, you found out that this company was going to be able to pave a lot more payment for less money. So you said, hey, pave some more for us. So again, my question, I guess, is the contracts that were the 29% or 69%, were they high number or high value contracts or low, you know? So I'm saying if you're evaluating, if the contract is a smaller amount of money, it's going to be tougher to make up for these things. Where if it's a large contract, I understand what you're saying. You can make up the bad estimates.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisden, I think really that's the point of the audit, is we needed to have better data to understand the impacts of having these unbalanced bids embedded in these projects. The fact of the matter is, whether us or the Secretary, they really don't know the accounting going on in these projects with unbalanced biddings. When we look at a program level, like I described, the 1.9 versus 1.8, really there's no flags or concerns there, but not to say when you get down into individual projects there may be some concerns. And really try to how to characterize that or how to quantify that, the fact of the matter is we really don't know, and the recommendations that they have in their four recommendations is for us to have a better understanding of that. So when we go make changes to the contracts through change orders or other extensions of time or other things, we have a richer knowledge of how that contractor put those contracts together and make sure we're not making decisions in a way that's going to cost the taxpayers more money.
Please proceed.
Good. So just turning to those four recommendations, the first three recommendations really have to do with the points I was just making of just having us better track the data, track the items, and being able to do that analysis on an individual project. So I will say we do track the unbalanced bid, so we have some knowledge of out there, but being able to really do the analysis that they describe in the audit is where we need to do some improvements. Already underway, we started late last year a procurement process to procure a piece of software that other states use that we'll be able to perform this analysis with. We're in final negotiations with that contractor now, should have them on board and implementing that new software in July and be able to start implementing that. And this time next year, we'll have a much better understanding of some of those items. Once we have that, we will also begin implementing recommendation number four, which is helping our project managers understand this data. So when they're out there making decisions on change orders, managing that contract on a day-to-day basis, they have some direction and some understanding of how the unbalanced bids affect the particular contract.
I'll start off with a few questions. In terms of the audit itself, there have been some discussion between your office and my office about the process and seeing some benefit to coming to this committee to explain your responses. And obviously that's not, that would never be considered to be in replacing the Secretary of State's role in terms of requiring responses from agencies. But do you find a benefit being able to come to committee? I mean, the Secretary of State's, this Secretary of State, previous Secretary of State's, have always felt that it would be better to get some visibility on the audits to bring them before a legislative committee. Is there a benefit, do you think, to the agencies to be able to present their side of the audit?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe so. We I guess just starting with how we view audits in general, they're a tool to make us better, and we really embrace that. We have an audit committee at the department. The director is the chair. We have members of our commission on there, senior managers. We do our own internal audits. We have a number of federal highway audits we go through. Secretary of State's office does audits. But we really view all of those as ways for us to get better. And we track the implementation of those, and having that opportunity to come and share what we're doing with you, how serious we take and our takeaways from those audits with the legislative committee, I think has benefit as well.
Okay. Follow up on your statement, I'll take a portion of it relative to that in some of your contracts you have escalators, and I'll use the example of steel. Mm-hmm. And it appears from what you said, the auditors looked at your contracts, looked at the number that went over the original bid amount, but didn't back that those out that actually were due to that factor. Do you think that's a lack of familiarity with the system from the auditor, or is there something else there? I mean, because they should have actually explained that. But I mean, I can honestly see that issue where, you know, projects sometimes take an incredible amount of time. And if the price of one of the core materials that you need goes up and you have an escalator right. In the contract that says if the price goes up, then the cost of the contract goes up, shouldn't they have backed that out from their estimates of how many had actually exceeded the original?
Right.
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, I think the essence of our response was that example, as well as others, they should have backed out of what we call the project accounting to come up with a true representation of those projects that were over.
I don't want to put you in a bad position, but do you think that was because of a lack of familiarity in the process, or?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's somewhat speculation on my part, but I think if you're trying to imagine myself in an auditor's shoes and coming in and expected to be, you know, an expert on ODOT contracting within a few months and make recommendations is a very challenging endeavor. Obviously, we are the experts in our contracting, but the value that we see with whether our internal auditors or Secretary of State's auditors, there are a separate set of eyes to come in and really look at our processes, our procedures from a fresh point of view that can, you know, really add value to us and challenge some of the things that we're assuming. I guess when I view kind of the ideal situation is you have an auditor come in asking those questions alongside of those experts with the topic area that they're auditing and really having those two things work together rather than potentially working against themselves.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, I really appreciated the time you took to talk about the difference between, you know, really the bid document and the bid, you know, budget, and then the project, you know, budget. I think that's such a big and important element of understanding the overall results and even looking at the audit itself. And, you know, I've always, my husband used to say that auditing, you know, well, first of all, he used to say that bidding was an art. Because, I mean, as a person who's bidding the job, you are trying as hard as you can to figure out the differences, not just in the price of steel or other possible escalators, but you're also trying to figure out where your machine is, how much time you've got on your machine, you know, how many machines you need, are you going to have to bring some other machines on, you know, are you going to have to contract for machines? I mean, all of these different things. And so I think it's a constantly ongoing sort of, you know, engaged process, right? And so to me, you know, the audit's worth, to me, was simply saying we all can do better knowing the system more.
Right.
And so, as you've already pointed out, there's at least 3 out of the 4 recommendations that you're trying to now gather more information on or better information. And then in the 4th recommendation, you're trying to figure out how to pass that on to managers.
That's correct. Yep.
And to me, that makes all the sense in the world, but it's an ongoing process that never stops. And so as a manager, when you see an opportunity for a project that may become a little bigger because there's some savings possible because of the one that you gave us in Eastern Oregon. But so I guess what I really want to know from reading this is, are there any challenges or barriers that you see right now in your system or in somehow what you have in the way of keeping the information or reviewing the information or analyzing the information? Are there challenges or barriers that you see in front of yourself to actually, you know, do something with all 4 of these recommendations?
Co-Chair McLean, you know, the barriers are implementing this new piece of software. You know, as I think technology enters more and more of our daily lives, technology at the department, both in the construction practices themselves as well as in our managing of them, becomes more and more bigger part and creates its own challenges of being able to keep that, so implementing that software, keeping it updated, making sure the data that's coming out of there is producing the type of information that's useful for you in managing the contracts. So those are the challenges, but I think in the 4 recommendations, I think they're fairly straightforward. I think we have kind of a work plan to execute those, and I don't foresee any really significant challenges in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand that you want to understand these unbalanced bids more. What I want to know is, how is this going to save us money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I think that's going to be the ultimate question. As I try to say, at a program level, we don't really see a problem in the overall thing, sense of it. But when you get in on a project-by-project basis, there could be. And I think that's what was pointed out by the Secretary of State's audit. ODOT, you really don't know some of the detailed fine-tunings on individual projects. And as you get in and understand that data, take analysis of that data, and then ensure that you are doing things as cost effectively as possible. What actual will be in savings, I think, remains to be seen. The fact of the matter is, we really don't know what that potential dollar amount could be until we actually have the data and begin to analyze it.
So, the way I understand this is, okay, first of all, you do low bid. You look at low bid. So all the contractors have the same information to start with. All of them can bid in any way they want, basically. Mm-hmm. And you take the lowest one that makes sense. I'm sure it's not completely low bid.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, it is the low qualified bidder.
The low qualified bidder, yes.
They have to meet, but then it's the low,
right.
The low amount is what we take.
So once you take that low bid and you say, okay, this is the lowest bid we got, but here's an unbalanced portion of this bid. We've learned how to figure this out now, and we see there's an unbalanced something here. What do you do at that point? Is there a negotiation after the bid process?
Chair Devlin, Senator Riley, I think if the project goes kind of as scripted, I don't think there's really anything we do. But if we're going to change that contract, certainly if we're going to do a change order, add time or other changes, which invariably almost happens on every project,
right.
We understand At the project manager level in ODOT has a good understanding of how the contractor put that contract together, and when we're making changes, we have that same understanding, and when we process change orders or do, you know, other things, we have that same knowledge. Now, exactly what we're going to do with that, I think, depends on the situation, but I think what the audit pointed out is, ODOT, you need to have that information and arm your project manager with that so they truly can be managing the contracts in a way that is the most cost-effective.
Okay. Can I?
Yes,
that just makes so much sense. I feel like, you know, my husband's gone. He died in 2009, but I remember him coming home around the kitchen table and he go, "I did such a good job on that bid. I can't believe what happened." Yep. You know, and he'd have spent, you know, a month on the bid, right, or whatever. And they were always, and so I can really see that information being good with the manager, because sometimes he would have managers coming and say, "Man, you know, you barely made your shirt on that one." You know, and I understand why you bid it that way, and it looked like we thought it was really close too, but mm-hmm. good grief, you know, give yourself some credit over here because you're doing so much more than we asked you to do.
Right.
You know, I mean, so the manager actually gets with the knowledge, with actually having that information right. and seeing where there is a, you know, an average bid, or there is a pretty low bid, or a unreasonable bid, well, then you have some choices to make when you're doing those change orders. And I think it sounds like a great use of some time, and I'm glad you guys right. are buying the software.
Good.
I have one follow-up question, good. And it's probably not on the audit. It's actually on your underlying process. I was just curious. Many of your projects are probably similar in nature, although that you do have a lot of engineering that goes into all of them and a lot of work in advance to determine what the project is, what's the scope of it, what the individual elements of it are. Is this as sophisticated when you get to, and I'm going to stay on the coast and I'm going to stay on the Willamette, I'm not going to talk about the Columbia, when you're actually doing bridges and you're restoring an existing bridge, do you have enough that you can actually estimate clearly based upon the different types of bridges we have in the state, what the cost of restoration would be? Is there enough history there or enough data out there to say what the cost should be?
As long as
you're not replacing it.
Yeah, I, you're exactly right. If you've ever done a home remodel or something, you know, knowing exactly what you're going to find when you tear those walls apart or get into the plumbing or the electrical, there's always some surprises, versus when you're building new, you know what the foundation is going to be, you know what the codes are, you know what you should be doing. So it's a lot less known. We have, especially in the last 10 years, done so much rehabilitation of bridges. We're becoming much better at it. But still, as we get into different projects, it almost always we find something that we didn't count on being there and have to make adjustments. While we have a contractor on site, we have to do what the bridge needs and make adjustments in the contract to account for those. We have a small amount of contingencies built into our contracts. Typically, those are about 3.5%, and we use those to take into account those types of things.
Okay.
I also want to underline what you said that I think is important, and that is about unbalanced bids are not necessarily on its face a bad thing.
Right.
Because you may have, you know, one person, like my husband had what they called a water jet machine, you know, and some other people didn't have a water jet machine, and they certainly didn't have one with the reach that he had. So something truly was a little bit easier for him to do on one machine than other people were trying to do on smaller machines or a couple of machines. And so, I mean, an unbalanced bid does not mean bad. It just means that there are certain contractors that have certain ways to
right.
keep costs down on a certain item. So I think that's important.
Right.
Anything additional? Your comments? Well, thank you very much for coming here today.
Thank you.
We'll close that item, and I think what we'll go to next is the discussion of audit review request form. The two co-chairs have had a chance to review this, but I think I'll turn it over to Ms. McHugh and have her go through it.
Sure, Mr. Co-chair.
And it should be online for you.
It is. It should be in your packet of materials. If you recall, at the last meeting, we had some examples from some other states of audit request forms, and they varied from basically asking what do you want to audit, to those that were very detailed and people needed to provide past audits, they needed to provide details of which statutes it would amend, all of those things. So this is obviously a draft form, but I took the liberty based on what I heard at the last meeting to put together kind of a draft form that we might consider using. And if you look at that item, the top of the form is really to identify what its purpose is. So again, this form would allow or provide information to this committee to determine, does the subject of the request warrant immediate attention? If it does, then who should conduct that work? Should it be the Secretary of State with a formal audit? Should it be assigned to JLAC staff to be reviewed or assigned to other legislative staff for review, which again could be coordinated with JLAC staff? And we'll have some examples I can talk about. Then if JLAC determines the subject is a lower priority than other audit review work and does not warrant immediate attention, should the topic be added to a list of topics, issues that are periodically reviewed and considered by JLAC and the Secretary of State? And if you recall, we heard the Secretary of State indicate that they keep a database with 300 to 400. So in other words, would we go ahead and keep create our own database, if you will, that we would keep and go through periodically? Not sure if you need to, there might be a time where you have to actually clean out the database and say which ones are going to just come off. But again, that would be a question. And then, of course, we make sure that it's clear that we may invite requesters to testify before the committee to learn more about the request before a decision is made. And that then requesters will be notified of the JLAC decision regarding the request. So on the request form itself, kept it pretty simple, name and title of the person requesting the audit or review, their contact information, the name of the agency, program, service, or function to be audited or reviewed, the reason for the audit or review, specific issues or areas of concern that should be addressed, and then if they have background materials or other information that would help JLAC or the actually audit review staff understand the issue, to be able to provide that. So
Teresa, the examples we looked at, we brought up this in, I think, our last meeting. Mm-hmm. Are we, the form that you've come up with or draft form you've come up with, does it have to be one of us? Can it be a legislator? Can it be a citizen? Or who's going to, do you want it to all come through us?
That is a good question, Representative Wisnant, Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnant. At this point, the way this has been put together would basically be out on the website, would allow anybody to come in and request that. That's clearly, though, an option for this group to decide and for this committee to decide, because, again, states do it differently. Some states, it is open to anyone.
Yeah.
In fact, one state, you don't even have to be in the state. I could request an audit or review be conducted. Now, I don't know my chances of it actually occurring. And then other states actually require it to go through presiding officers before they are willing to put something on
this. And some states require more than a single member to request.
Yeah,
they require a certain number of members.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the underlying reality is you could open it as wide as you want to open it, but the end of the process is very narrow in terms of how many actual performance audits the Secretary of State has actually funded. Mm-hmm. To actually accomplish, so you have to be very selective. And
there should be we're just having some free conversation. I won't go.
Yeah. So
I think it should be funneled down, Oak. I mean, and we got to be, if we open it up to anyone, what kind of volume are we going to get and not be responsive? So I think, I think that's a concern. I want, you know, anyone, I want ideas for anyone. I know that it can come from anyone, but if we open it all away, are we going to, we're creating a bureau or an organization. That
well,
we
and there are other revenues, other
avenues.
There are other avenues also.
Yeah.
I think obviously members of the public can come to any member of the legislature.
Yeah. And I think that's what I would like to say is maybe anyone can suggest it, but you first have to go to your legislature,
right.
Legislator,
yeah.
And then let that legislator bring it to this committee or something.
Yeah.
I
that's
like
how
that.
I see it as well.
I like that.
And I think we both said that out loud too.
Okay.
That we wanted to bring it here and find out what you felt, but we both suggested that we thought it should have some kind of a connection to a legislator.
Yeah. And the other thing there is that, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be their legislator, but they're, I mean, they should go there first, but actually they can go to someone else, but it should be a legislator making the request for consideration. Also, even though we can't do it this session because of other reasons, bills that are put forward asking for audits of specific entities, those bills should actually come to this committee. Mm-hmm. So if somebody puts in a bill asking for a specific audit, they should come to this committee for, you know.
Still like a legislator sharing responsibility or filtering it or saying that I know this guy and he's going to ask for a bunch of audits. And he's going to ask everything be audited, you know, which doesn't achieve what we can accomplish. It's going to make it a bottleneck. That, I like opening up to everyone, but I think if you come to you, I still like your legislator. Hopefully he knows what the subject or the guy or something like that.
And everybody has two.
Yeah.
Right.
Same thing.
Have a House member and a senator.
I don't think I don't think that y'all discuss. I don't think you need five or whatever one state said you have to have at least.
I think it should be on the merits of the proposal, actually. So. Okay. Any additional discussion on this item?
So one thing that I was thinking about is some legislators have very few bills and others have a lot of bills. Do we want to talk about how many audit suggestions a legislator can bring forward?
That might actually, maybe it's not a place to make a decision today, but that might be a worthwhile discussion because if you get to make three requests in a session, let's say, or in a year, you think a lot about what those three requests are.
Right.
Knowing that we will be able to forward very few of them on to the Secretary of State, and we'll have to make, but if we get 100 requests from one legislator, which is not an unheard of number for bills.
Oh, I know. I have them in my committee.
I think I wouldn't mind putting a number.
Yeah.
But oh, never say never. You know, extraordinary, or if you have a something that really, you know, you've already given your three or got your three submitted.
And you got one more priority. Save it.
Something like that. We wouldn't want to close the door on something that really needs to be addressed. Or,
well, you can always go to, if we say that each legislator could submit three requests in a year, he or she can always go to another legislator and ask them to submit it on their behalf and use one of their...
Yeah, that already gives us, 120 times 3, 360 things that we have to look at.
Maybe better go to
270.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. All right, well, now we should give senators, we should give House members 2 and senators 5, right? Is that what you said?
I think that's a very amusing idea.
I'm the only minority member here, so I know all about the 2 and the unlimited number of committee chairs.
Representative Nathanson isn't even going to react to me. She's over there.
She's used to you.
I really like the idea of limiting it because I do think it makes people think a little harder about what their top priorities are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality of this in performance audits is, you know, let's say we actually did get the maximum, the 270. We can make a number of requests to the Secretary of State, but he, in this case, might only be able to do 4 or 5 or 6 of them in a year, you know.
So we're sort of just informally talking. Mm-hmm. I liked your comment to him about, you know, the Secretary of State versus this committee, whether he feels it's good.
Yeah.
Does the Secretary of State on an audit, did the executive branch get a copy, and did they have someone that looks, you know?
I mean, everybody that's here is the executive branch that's coming before us, in a sense.
Co-Chair, Representative Wisnant, yes, every audit is also sent to the governor's office and to DAS. They don't necessarily take action on everyone to get involved, but they do have those as well.
Thank you.
And, of course, they're all online. Anybody can look at them.
I would like to follow up since DAS was mentioned. Mm-hmm. We're all very familiar with DAS's role in preparing a budget and being able to look at all the lines and the various accounting and budgeting systems, and we see people from budget management or CFO, it's other name, come to the witness table and make statements about agency budgets that or other requests that come to Joint Ways and Means. But what we're seeing is just one or two aspects of the role of BAM or CFO. To what extent is that office involved in oversight so that as audits are reviewed, they're following up from the executive branch perspective? What are you doing to fix this or fix that? I don't see that because it's just not part of their ordinary testimony here, but how much of their time does that office spend in that aspect of their responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, we'd really probably have to have George Naughton come to say what's happening today. I have ancient history. If Ken Rock were here, he'd say super ancient history. But that, in my experience, when I was there under different governors, that varied to some degree by the governor's office and what role the governor chose to take. So some governors used the Budget and Management Division to be very active in management review and in dealing with management issues within agencies, often assigning staff from that unit. I worked in several agencies when there were issues that occurred there. And other governors chose not to do as much, using their own personal staff or not being as involved. So, you know, that is certainly something if you'd like to have either George and really then Katie Koba come at some point and talk about what they see their role in terms of oversight, and we could do that. Yeah.
Can I clarify your response to you?
Yes.
If in your time there, and it wasn't that long ago. But,
thank you.
if in a financial audit they found a financial irregularity, I would guess that would be a more immediate response to. And if it's in a performance audit and it's maybe something that isn't being done well, it would probably more depend upon whether there was that broad focus by the executive branch on the performance of individual entities and the relative importance they gave that individual entity. Because if it's a problem in DHS, it's probably at the top of the list. If it's a problem in, who should I pick on? Health Licensing Board.
Well, it comes down to who gets in the Oregonian most.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever.
Co-Chair Devlin, if there was a financial irregularity, we were on that pretty quickly, and often we would actually bring in that case, less budget and management and more the state accounting unit, the other part of what is now under CFO, to say we need to make sure that people are over there and looking at that. Some of what Senator Riley mentioned is true in terms of we had agencies that were showing that there were significant management issues in terms of I spent some time in human services. I spent some time at the lottery. I mean, so as agencies had management crises of some kind, then often we were there to help through that process. I mean, it was basically to help transition.
But
don't you think that Representative Nathanson's idea, I mean, I think it's a nice place to start to find out what are we doing status quo today?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that would hurt us. And that actually brings us to our second, you know, document.
Yeah.
That's talking about, you know, first of all, we have to have a methodology of what are you doing with these audits. And then we have to have, you know, basically a review, assign and review process and a follow-up conduct process or, you know, how we're going to deal with them. And I think the second page that Teresa has for us is really trying to acknowledge that, you know, that piece of it. And I hope we can do that.
Okay. And then Representative Wisnett.
Go ahead. Well, thank you, Ms. Kutcher. You know, we made fun about that they get it online. But my background in the military, if the Secretary of State info DAS and the governor's office, that's different. Putting it on the document and say they have a copy.
It is different.
You are the chain of command here. I would really, you know, we're not, I'll mention, I think I still have a relationship with the Secretary of State. I've suggested his audit, unless we need legislation to do that, that his audits, when they're sent to the agency, that there be a copy to DAS and to the executive branch or the governor, whatever we want to say. But
and they may be doing that. Yeah, I know that we received at least a specific email saying it's now.
But I think that's a little more than, you know, we're casually talking.
Right.
To say it's online, they should be doing it because they've got 1,000 things to do. But if you put their name on that document, say you are a part of this agency.
If we could go back for a moment, the one case I was going to cite that was recent, see how we think of time. Recent is a couple of years. That's recent. When we had the situation with Doug Ammey, that wasn't actually a situation of malfeasance. It was found not to be. But I think DAS brought in people there almost instantly.
Thank you.
To basically, it's almost gave me the... It almost sounded to me like when the IRS goes into a business and locks the doors and says, what is actually going on here?
Didn't you go through an IG in the military? Did you have an inspector
general?
See, both of you were in the military.
Yeah. So, okay. This has been a good discussion. Should we go on to the next item? Are people prepared for the next item on this? That's discussion of criteria and priorities for audit review selection. It's also online if you don't have it physically here.
It's the next one, it's work plan methodology. Again, in addition to the forum, we talked about how do we look through and determine where we think we should spend our efforts, whether it's our suggestion to the Secretary of State, whether it's your suggestion to me or whoever is staff. So again, in looking at other states and then listening to the committee, put this draft together. So the first is about a criteria. So when you're setting a work plan, that you review and prioritize the requests for audits review. Work with the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to determine whether the review of agency performance measures indicates the need for an audit review. So in addition to the request from the form we just talked about, to also, and remember the law kind of requires JLAC to look at performance measures, to work with Ways and Means on which performance measures are indicating, you know, has there been a series of issues or something that's popped up that really indicates there's a performance issue in this agency potentially. And then the prioritization of work, or at least of your ability to review what work you would recommend, would be based on looking at magnitude of risk. That includes the size and complexity of the budget or programs, the essential nature of the programs and services, the likelihood of performance failure, a current crisis exists, et cetera. So it's basically having staff do some kind of review of magnitude. That's on the risk side. The other side is the magnitude of potential benefit to Oregonians of an audit. Could it reduce costs and or increase the quality of services and programs? As with what you heard from the Secretary of State, you always have to look at the availability of information as the topic auditable. In fact, one state actually then did an audit on availability of information. Where did they run into places that didn't have information? And then they ended up being able to provide some more direction there. But you have to have that to actually do something. And then, does a recent audit or review already exist? And is there no change in available information? So that would be kind of the first blush that you would probably ask staff to at least help you have a sense of that.
So if I may, we're talking about availability of information. Is the topic auditable? In my humble opinion, the lack of information to do audit is probably a very bad sign that should be looked at very carefully. Mm-hmm. It's more important maybe than the audits you were going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Co-Chair Devlin, Senator Riley. In fact, I think one of the things about it being on there is the whole piece of can you audit it, but is also making sure the committee knows there is no information on this. And again, at some point you may want to do the same thing as the other state and look at those. The second category is then once you've done that is to review and assign audit review work. And the real key there is which one should be forwarded to the Secretary of State Audits Division, remembering that they follow national standards, and which ones should be reviewed and evaluated by JLAC or other legislative staff. And again, we'll go through kind of the list we had last time and give some kind of sense of which ones make maybe more sense to be done internally and which ones make more sense to go to the Secretary of State, but remembering you have staff as well that can do some of this. Mm-hmm. And then the final piece is, you know, according to the law today, there's kind of a clear understanding that a lot of performance audits or reviews should be contracted staff, so that you have subject matter experts, that there are topics that you actually want somebody who's not a generalist, but you want somebody that truly understands how to do this kind of work. So you may also be providing direction about those that you would like to see subject matter experts be involved.
Yes. I think that we have heard from Secretary of State they do contract, and I'm glad about that.
Yes.
Because some audits are going to take more than, and you don't want to build up a staff in Secretary of Staff's office that's, you know, going to be for the big ones, but you never have a big one, or you don't have enough big ones to justify that, those FTEs.
And then the third piece on the work plan is to ensure audit review follow-up is conducted. And again, that could be your staff to conduct follow-up on audits reviews to determine whether actions have been taken that are appropriate, and also to follow up on whether or not this committee has action that they need to take. Again, remembering the committee can introduce legislation or the referral of an issue to another legislative committee for review, but that we would actually conduct some of that work as well. And we know the Secretary of State does some of that work. Well, they do that work, although it tends to be on a 3 years out, so you may want, there may be those that you would want JLAC staff to kind of follow up on a little earlier in terms of whether or not there's any needed change in legislation.
Representative McLean.
Well, I feel that Representative Nathanson's comment, you know, also might fit in here as well, that we would have a connection to the administration, so DAS or the governor's office, as far as finding out if they are following up, because we wouldn't want duplicative efforts. And so we'd want to have them do it, or maybe us do it, or, you know, there would only be a few times maybe where there needed to be more than one resolve.
Well, I think, though, in terms of review, I think the executive branch review wouldn't substitute for a legislative review.
No,
would be
no. But I mean, as far as what we would do, I mean, yeah. Because this last piece is supposed to be actually finish up the circle.
Yeah.
You know, so whether it's having them make, you know, some reports to us, you know, to find out if they're going to be keeping track of it, like the Secretary of State does for 3 years, and so they're going to give us updated reports. But we want to know some administrative function is happening.
Yeah. Okay. Anything additional at this point? I think what I would suggest then is that Ms. McHugh take these recommendations and come back to us at a future meeting, and then we will okay each one of these documents in the sense of the form and in the sense of criteria. And I'm wondering about, we're still struggling with this. We have about 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 different requests for audits. One of the problems we have with a committee like this is there are three and three. Mm-hmm. And technically, we're not supposed to have a quorum unless it's a public meeting. And technically, it's not a quorum for there to be three of you on that side and three on this side meeting. But it just doesn't
feel right?
It doesn't feel right. Because anything a committee does in this building that's a joint committee has to have a majority on both sides. Even though we rarely get to that point other than just deciding what's on the agenda. Hopefully that will change. But I was wondering if Ms. McHugh might have the time, if the subcommittee chairs could go through this list and designate each one of us to maybe look at one or two of these subjects with Ms. McHugh and go through our own criteria, at least our prospective criteria on them, and then come back to the committee maybe in 2 weeks. So that, I mean, Ms. McHugh would have to set up probably 30, 45 minutes with each one of us. Mm-hmm. I know that'd be hard to do. But to go over one of these topic issues and then maybe develop literally a preliminary so that when we get back here, we might have 6, 8, 10 that we would select from and then make some sort of a final recommendation 2 weeks from now, which would be close to the end of this month.
Correct.
To be honest. And so other than that, I think I'm a little bit conscious that this is about the first time that I can recall, other than just miscellaneous requests to the Secretary of State, this committee has ever acted as a body saying to the Secretary of State. And I want the first request to be a meaningful request, to have some thought into it, not just simply a list of items. Mm-hmm. So if we could go through our own process that we're talking about and actually see whether these suggestions are good suggestions, what maybe needs to be modified in them to make them good, I think that would be beneficial. And hopefully we could be to the point, maybe by the meeting 2 weeks from now, to actually make a recommendation to the Secretary of State. I don't know if I haven't had a chance to talk to Representative McLean about that before this meeting.
I feel like that's an excellent idea. That was the whole idea that I wanted to see us have, you know, some real criteria and risk analysis, yeah, and that we would actually have an opportunity to have a process that people could understand and know. And so I'm ecstatic.
Yeah. And actually, I think it'll give Ms. McHugh a chance to talk to other LFO analysts who are familiar with some of the areas. And although she's familiar with them all, but just to see what steps or how we might want to narrow a request to make it more meaningful. So,
Mr. Cochera, that's fine. And again, one of the things we've already kind of started to do is talk about which ones, for example, looking at vacant state positions and how many positions a state should have compared to national standards. That's more likely to be one that I would recommend. Not that it doesn't have some huge magnitude issues, but that's one that LFO with Jay Lackstaff is probably very competent to do that maybe isn't a highest priority or really yellow book standard kind of review. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be done, but so I can then come in and talk about those, as well as we have a couple more that have come in as well. So
yeah,
I can talk to everybody about those.
And really and truly, I think that's part of the criteria that was suggested today to really look, is this Secretary of State, you know, is this JLAC staff, you know, is this LFO? So I think that goes right along with the criteria.
Okay, great.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order today?
The only other thing I would let the committee know is I have been informed that we have a new director of the Division of Audits. His name is Kip Mehmet, I believe is how you say it, and he originally came from Denver and has been working with the Treasurer's Office as their auditor, and is the new director of audits.
And
so,
he was the municipal auditor there,
correct,
right?
In Denver, I believe so. So I'm
Secretary of State.
We'll see if we can get him to come to a future meeting, and so you have a chance to meet the new auditor.
Okay. Well, great. With that, we're adjourned.
Good. Thank you.
And my battery ran out.
Thank you.